Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing protests and looting in Ferguson, Missouri, in spite of an intervention by the governor and the deployment of a more community-friendly, less militarized state police force. Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, joins us to discuss her recent article in the New York Times, Get the Military Off Main Street, and the lobbying efforts of she and her colleagues for the past year on Capitol Hill to block the Pentagon's handout of surplus military weapons and hardware to police forces across the country, known as the 1033 program, that has resulted in the streets of Ferguson looking like a war zone. Then, with President Obama curtailing his vacation to deal with the volatile situations in Ukraine and Iraq as a joint U.S. and Kurdish military operation to retake the Mosul Dam is underway, we will discuss the precarious decision-making situation the president is in, with the possibility of the Islamic State retaliating by unleashing a monstrous and catastrophic tidal wave across Iraq that will flood the country and plunge it into darkness. Dr. Stephen Walt, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Double Dis, and the upside and the downside for the president at a time when his foreign policy is not just being criticized by Republicans, but is being second-guessed by one of its architects, the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Then finally, we will speak with Darrell West, the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. He joins us to discuss his recent article in USA Today, Republican Big Bucks Backfire, that suggests much of the massive and unprecedented campaign spending by plutocrats to elect Republicans to do their political bidding might reverse itself and over time go to Democrats as these conservative donors age and their liberal children inherit their fortunes. And joining us now is Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She has an article at the New York Times with Michael Shank, Get the Military Off Main Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
And I was surprised to learn, Elizabeth, that you and your colleagues have been working on legislation for the last year on Capitol Hill, lobbying lawmakers to stop this 1033 program that was enacted by Congress in 1997 to dispense extra military gear to police forces across the country. And, of course, we've seen manifestations of that with the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, looking like a war zone. So give us a sense of how the legislation is proceeding and whether it's going to get a bump from what's happening now.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, my organization, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, we're located right here in Washington, D.C., and we became aware of this program back in the fall and felt really concerned about it and sort of had this looming sense that something might happen, like has been happening in Ferguson, and we asked Congress to respond and to put some oversight over this program, which was sorely lacking at the time. And Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia stepped right up to the plate and has really been taking leadership and pushing for legislation and drafting language that would stop the transfer of the specifically military-grade weapons and machinery to the local police and also adding some oversight that didn't previously exist. So that's been in the works for a few months. We conducted a briefing a few weeks ago, actually. It was right before all of this happened. It was about a month ago at this point. We were joined by former police chief of Seattle, Norm Stamper, along with a representative of the ACLU. They just put out a great report on police militarization. They also have been looking at this program for a while and have been supportive of legislation. We're also joined by Radley Balco, who wrote the incredible book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, documenting exactly how this has been gradually happening. So, you know, it's a mixed feelings. We're glad that this issue is getting the attention that it deserves and hope that the bill will start getting some traction. But we're so very sorry for the circumstances that led to this attention.
And, of course, the circumstances keep changing all the time. In Ferguson, Missouri, it's hard to keep track of what's been happening, and of course, some of the reporting by nature of evolving events has been a little inaccurate. In fact, I had reported, as others had, that the policeman in question was well known to the community. And of course, the police weren't releasing his name up until recently, and that he was allegedly as well known to the community as a sort of serial harasser. And that turns out not to be the case. So it's difficult to follow this, but of course, it's depressing to think that there has been the need for another curfew and looting has taken place, although the police do have a smaller footprint.
Yeah, that's right. It's been very difficult to keep up with the changes. It's a rapidly expanding situation and developments are always coming up. And I think what a lot of the changes have shown us is exactly what my organization and many others have been saying for quite a while, which is that when you employ these militarized tactics, it tends to ignite pre-existing tensions that have been sort of lingering under the surface for quite a while. There's racial disparities there. There's all sorts of implications for why that tension exists. But then once police come in basically with guns blazing, with tank-like structures and pointing guns at citizens, it escalates the tension. It doesn't de-escalate, which is supposed to be the goal for crowd control. And especially when we saw in the last couple of days Captain Ron Johnson taking over and the State Highway Patrol replacing St. Louis County and sort of governing the situation, we saw police coming out, walking the streets, embracing some of the protesters, asking them what they were there for, speaking with them, engaging with them as if they're humans, not as if they're the enemy. Suddenly you see a lot of calm, you see a completely de-escalated situation, and it's been like night and day is what they said, which is exactly what many critics of this program have been saying, that you can't defend having these sorts of weapons and machinery due to needing them to control crowds or something of that sort, because it doesn't control the crowds. It escalates and it ignites things that were already there. So we're glad to see some of the tensions de-escalating. We hope with the new curfews that the peace continues, because it's sort of the slogan of my organization that war is not the answer, and we typically mean that internationally. But the truth is, it's the case domestically as well, that the shooting, everything that happened, responding with a military first tactic is not the way to go. And the funny thing is that these exact same weapons of war that were designed to withstand, landmines and explosions overseas, they're right here in Main Street now. So the exact same policies we've been using internationally, unchecked military, unchecked war, it's coming home now into an unchecked military presence in the streets, and that's something that absolutely has to change, which is why we're supporting Congressman Johnson's bill.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Beavers, who's the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She has an article at the New York Times with Michael Schenck, Get the Military Off Main Street. And it does seem obvious, Elizabeth, that the police are there to police communities as opposed to wage war against them with military equipment. And the very presence of military equipment suggests an attitude that the citizens of the community are the enemy, as opposed to people that you're supposed to protect and serve. So tell me, though, about the extent to which this 1033 program from the Pentagon, which allows for surplus military equipment to be given to police departments across the country, and it's led to this militarization of police. Apparently, a part of the program, a condition of getting this equipment, is that you've got to use it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And so what you're referencing there, for your listeners, it's the 1033 program. It was enacted by Congress in 1997. And it basically just says that the Department of Defense can transfer its surplus equipment, whether new or used, to local police, to local law enforcement agencies at no cost. So you've got all 50 U.S. states, 4 U.S. territories are recipients of the program. They've given out nearly $5 billion worth of equipment ever since this program has come into existence. And it's led to the formation of more SWAT teams. It's led to exactly the kind of responses we've seen at Ferguson, and exactly what you said there, that one of the regulations is that you're supposed to use the equipment within 1 year, And if you don't need it, you're supposed to give it back. But that's not usually what happens. Usually they hang on to it and they have it sort of indefinitely. And when they have it, they want to use it, even if it wasn't a regulation. I think that's just common sense that when you have a new toy, you want to play with it. And so in the absence of violent crime or extremism, what we're seeing is they're sending out their SWAT teams for low-level drug raids or to execute search warrants or other sort of run-of-the-mill everyday policing activities, and that completely escalates other situations and has led to a completely militarized force, a show of force, whenever there's just routine law enforcement that's supposed to be being done. Another problem I want to highlight that hasn't gotten a lot of coverage is that, you know, there's the obvious program, the obvious problem of militarization through the 1033 program, but there's also this huge element of waste, fraud, and abuse, which is that when local law enforcement are receiving these items, they can't always account for them later on. And they're supposed to be keeping a really detailed inventory, but there's not really anybody looking after that. So there are all these cases of police trying to sell the weapons, trying to lend them to unauthorized friends, losing them. There's a report of a Humvee being unaccounted for. A law enforcement official in my home state of North Carolina pled guilty to selling over $30,000 worth of M16s on eBay that he had received through the program for free. So it's kind of become a free-for-all, and it's a really dangerous weapons flow that it's the second part of this bill that the congressman's been working on, is to put some oversight in there and track, okay, once people have these things, what are they doing with them and where are they? It's just sort of they've been given this privilege of having free equipment, and there should be some responsibility that comes with it.
And this equipment is one of the last bits of gun control left in the United States. Goes back to the days of Al Capone, when the government enacted a ban on fully automatic weapons like Tommy guns. And even the NRA has not been able to overturn that ban. You can't buy fully automatic weapons at gun stores in the United States, although it's technically fairly easy to change a semi-automatic to a fully automatic. But nevertheless, the point I wanted to make is that these police forces are getting fully automatic military weapons, are they not?
Yeah, that's correct. And actually, there's the website of the 1032 program itself is pretty explicit about the sort of weapons and machinery that they're transferring. There's some scary things like grenade launchers, and obviously there are these mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles. There's M16s, AR-15s, assault rifles, Kevlar helmets, you name it.
Well, you can't complain about policemen wearing protective clothing, because, unfortunately, there are a lot of armed criminals, thanks to the NRA. We have the best armed criminals in the country, in the world, I should say. But surely you don't need, there's a companion program with Homeland Security that's apparently distributed more than $34 billion of this similar equipment under the rubric of terrorism. I remember interviewing somebody a while back talking about a small police force in a tiny little town in Idaho getting scuba equipment based upon the idea that somehow terrorists would swim across a lake. I mean, I don't know that there are too many targets of opportunity in rural Idaho, but apparently it doesn't matter.
Right, that's exactly right. I'm glad you brought up that program, because the reaction we're seeing in Ferguson comes from a mix of the 1033 program and also what some people call the terrorism grants that are handed out by the Department of Homeland Security. They have handed out almost $35 billion, and that's not equipment, that's just cash. That's just grants that are handed out to purchase this equipment on their own. Yeah, that's exactly right. There was a small town that received a lot of scuba equipment and boats, and actually the town in question was totally landlocked, nowhere near a body of water. There was another town that received like a warehouse full of bayonets, which I don't even know when's the last time we needed bayonets, or what's, you know, they're pretty much sitting in a warehouse collecting dust now, I suppose. But there's been some great covers lately. There's been bouncy houses that are transferred. There's dog goggles. There's just kind of crazy items, you know. But what we really take offense to are items that were specifically designed and intended for the military. This isn't to say that law enforcement are bad guys or they're poorly intentioned. It's that they are separate from the military. They have separate responsibilities, separate laws, separate equipment. And so blurring the lines between those two institutions is dangerous, because then you start blurring the behavior. And a military response, which actually Senator Rand Paul noted in the great op-ed he did, is supposed to be different from a police response. And together between the DHS grants and the 1033 program, it's making it way easy to blur those lines.
So, Elizabeth Beavers, the work that you're doing on Capitol Hill for the last year, lobbying legislators to try and overturn this 1033 military grant program from the Pentagon that's proliferating military weapons into police forces across the country. You were joined, I believe, by Norm Stamper, the former chief of police of Seattle, and he had a sort of come-to-Jesus moment with the famous or infamous WTO demonstrations, the so-called Battle of Seattle, where tear gas and dogs were used. And he has, of course, come to regret all of that, suggesting that tear gas really should never be used against nonviolent and non-threatening protesters, and dogs being used similarly is an ugly echo of the race riots of the 1960s in the South with Sheriff Bull Connors. So he was traveling around with you on Capitol Hill lobbying congressmen, along with, you mentioned the author of the book, Rise of the Warrior Cop by Radley Balco. He also is a fellow at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian organization. And you mentioned Rand Paul as well being championing this issue. So how are you doing since, you know, this crosses a fairly broad political spectrum, does it not, from your group on the left, if that's not making you uncomfortable, to the Cato Institute on the right?
Yeah, well, you know, I will note FCNL is a nonpartisan institution, and we take a lot of stances that are sometimes considered progressive and sometimes not. But yeah, that's exactly right. We were joined by Radley, by Norm, and also by Kara Damsky, who's a representative from the ACLU and authored their recent report, The War Comes Home, Militarization of U.S. Police, which everybody should check out. That fantastic report. It documents a lot of true stories of police brutality and militarization, and talks about how they were funded by the 1033 program. But yes, we conducted a briefing, and the response was incredible. It was packed house, standing room only. There was so much interest in this subject way before Ferguson even happened. And, you know, for me as a lobbyist, this has been a really fun issue to work on, if you can call, you know, a dark subject like this fun, because I get to talk to just radically different congressional offices and kind of hear them say the same thing. From the left of the left to the right of the right, and several people in between, there's just sort of a human visceral response when you see police officers responding with basically tanks and with assault weapons. It just sort of does something, no matter where you're coming from politically. And, you know, I think it definitely speaks to the potential success of this legislation, because you know, the bill actually doesn't end the 1033 program completely. It just blocks the specific military-grade items from going through and asks that the law enforcement agencies demonstrate a minimum amount of responsibility and accountability. And that's something that's really difficult to argue with, because, you know, especially our more conservative friends are concerned about the waste, fraud, and abuse that I mentioned, and the idea of an all-powerful, you know, law enforcement government presence that isn't being checked and isn't receiving oversight from the Congress that instituted it in the first place. And then a lot of the friends on the left and the libertarians are especially concerned about the militarization. So it's something that it's one of those rare issues that the left and the right come together on. And I'm really looking forward to, as things start to settle in Ferguson, and, you know, in the weeks that follow, I hope that we don't forget this and we transfer all that anger we felt into moving this legislation along and making sure things like this don't happen anymore.
Well, there's nothing more disconcerting than having weapons pointed at you, and it normally happens in combat. It's not supposed to happen on the streets of America, and the people that are pointing the weapons at you should not be the people who are supposed to protect and serve, as opposed to the enemy. And when you see these pictures of the police pointing their guns and snipers, police snipers, you know, sighting people through their scopes, it does make you wonder whether many of the police forces across the country have forgotten their basic duty, which is to defend and protect life, not to take life. And the idea that they have a license to kill that is being abused is truly, it's frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our friend Norm Stamberg talks about the utilization of militaristic tactics in Seattle as one of the great mistakes of his life. And he talks about how it made the situation worse, and to respond in a more calm and de-escalating way is the actual way to promote peace and to promote security. And, the police are not supposed to be soldiers or warriors. They're the community. They're all civilians. The community is supposed to be one of them. They're supposed to be part of it. And, you know, Norm speaks so often about the idea of community policing and what law enforcement might look like if, as a cooperative, the community and the police together were working to protect one another and looking to promote law and order. And what would that look like instead of turning it into an us versus them battle every time? And, you know, one would imagine, and we've kind of seen Ferguson from one day to the next, where the local militarized police were removed and the more community-oriented State Highway Patrol was put in. Captain Ron Johnson took over, and we see the difference of how the crowds responded and the more peaceful presence that existed after that. So I think we've seen Norm's theory in action in the last few days, and I think he might be correct, and hopefully people will start listening to that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Beavers, who's the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She has an article at the New York Times with Michael Schenck, Get the Military Off Main Street. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the precarious decision-making situation the president is in as he's being criticized by Republicans and second-guessed by his former Secretary of State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances and Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-authored with John Mearsheimer. His latest article at Foreign Policy is Double Dis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you.
And the president has cut short his vacation in Martha's Vineyard to return to Washington to meet, I think, with his national security team. And it does seem that at this moment, when you have the Islamic State in possession of the Mosul Dam, which is the main source of electricity and water, which itself is an accident waiting to happen, and if the IS were to open the locks or just fail to maintain the dam, it could burst and send a 65-foot tidal wave of water through Mosul, which is 30 miles downstream, and all the way to Baghdad and to the Gulf and cause untold damage. At the same time, the president is employing military force against ISIS. to try and dislodge them from this dam. So to my mind, that's a pretty high-stake situation. It could end up as a major catastrophe, and it doesn't seem like an appropriate time to be criticizing the President of the United States when he's got such a difficult task on his hands.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's obviously an extremely tricky situation, and I think, Obama has been mindful of the risks. It's clear he does not want to see the United States become deeply engaged or entangled in Iraq in the future. But if you look at some of the things that have been happening there, it at least creates the possibility that we might be able to do something positive. He's worried about the slippery slope, but also worried both about the humanitarian crisis that struck the Yazidi, this religious minority, but also the possibility of a really large-scale disaster involving the dam. The one point is that these are actually moments when we ought to be debating foreign policy issues, not just sort of telling the president to do whatever he wants. So in times that are really critical, I think it's important to have open discussions of different options and what the pros and cons of different approaches might be.
Well, I should have been more precise in my question. I wasn't suggesting it, because here you and I are criticizing Obama, at least analyzing his foreign policy. I wasn't referring to us so much as to Hillary Clinton, somebody that was his Secretary of State. And it seemed to me that given how the Republicans are piling on, how John McCain almost every other day criticizes Obama for not being robust and tough and being a wimp and all this sort of stuff, it doesn't really help, I think. In fact, the fact that the Weekly Standard endorsed Hillary Clinton, I think, says it all.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that Hillary understood, the timing, in a sense that when she gave this interview, she may not have fully understood that this was going to appear at a moment where suddenly the United States and President Obama were going to be dragged sort of back into Iraq. I think the interview, interview she gave with the Atlantic Monthly several weeks ago, in which at several points she's subtly critical or sort of directly critical of President Obama for not being quite forceful enough. I think that was, sort of a narrowly political interview where she was attempting to walk a very fine line of separating herself in certain ways from Obama, particularly given that approval ratings for his foreign policy are pretty low right now. But it's tricky because she was part of his team and she can't sort of completely repudiate everything he has stood for, because that inevitably implicates her service as Secretary of State to some degree, and also alarms people in the Democratic base.
Well, she's pretty specific, though, about what she thought was his failures in Syria, and it's pretty hard to understand how anybody could be arguing that we should have armed the Syrian opposition, whoever they are, although we are apparently arming them in any case, or elements of them, given that ISIS or IS were able to capture all of those arms that we gave to the Iraqis. And there is a stark example of the dangers of pouring fuel on a fire in the middle of a civil war.
Yeah, I'd make two points there. First of all, President Obama pushed back rather vigorously against this line of argument and pointed out that anyone who thinks we could have actually made things better by dropping lots of arms into the rebels isn't really being very serious about this. It's always very easy when things have gone badly, as they certainly have in Syria, to do 20/20 hindsight and say, gee, we should have done X, we should have done Y, we should have done Z. But I think if one looks carefully at the actual circumstances there, Obama was correct to not make a very bad situation worse, and it would almost certainly not have prevented the emergence of ISIS, which really has its roots, of course, in the war in Iraq and emerged out of the al-Qaeda-linked groups that arose in response to the American occupation there. The second point I'd make is that what Hillary is prescribing there was something that there was no enthusiasm for in the American people. There are a number of people sort of in the U.S. foreign policy elite who are very enthusiastic about getting the United States involved in the Syrian civil war, but the American people were against it, and that's what Congress learned a couple of summers ago when they, Obama, you know, flirted with the idea of going in, and congressmen went back, you know, in the autumn recess and discovered that most of their constituents weren't at all interested in this. So this is a case where I think Hillary is taking a position for which there really isn't much popular support.
And it would seem that I think her remarks have backfired. I mean, she had to go through this cringing ritual of hugging Obama, at least saying she promised to hug him at a birthday party for Vernon Jordan's wife. So again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walters, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University and the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Responses to U.S. Primacy and the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-authored with John Mearsheimer. His latest article at Foreign Policy is Double Dis. And in terms of your latest article at Foreign Policy, Stephen Walters, you suggest that by extension, Hillary Clinton's actually criticizing her own husband's foreign policy, which was at the time criticized for being too timid in the way that Obama's being criticized. I remember, well, first of all, Black Hawk Down in Somalia. He retreated very quickly after that happened, and he took an agonizingly long time to get involved in the former Yugoslavia and the Balkans. So, I mean, if you look at the record, though, of the Obama administration foreign policy and particularly the stewardship of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, a lot of it's blown up in her face. We talked about Syria, certainly, and Obama himself said Libya, that was his greatest regret. Apparently, Samantha Power and Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton were the ones that kind of pushed Obama into Libya. And this whole Benghazi thing that the Republicans have ginned up is obviously an attempt to sully her reputation. Do you think that she should just shut up about this stuff? I mean,
well, if she intends to run for president, of course, we still don't know if she's ultimately going to throw her hat in the ring, although I think smart money believes she will. She's going to have to be able to articulate a sort of well-organized and coherent defense of her views on foreign policy. Ever since she began running for office, running for the U.S. Senate in New York, she has taken generally hawkish positions on most foreign policy issues. She was a vocal supporter of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and has generally adopted a pretty muscular approach to foreign policy all along. And unfortunately, that's, I think, going to be at least somewhat at odds with where the American people are at. And it's also going to be difficult to defend in light of how some of those actions have worked out. You mentioned the intervention in Libya, which she apparently, helped push, and certainly her advocacy of a more forceful response in Syria, I think, would be ultimately hard to defend on the campaign trail. I think what's going on here, though, is, in a sense, this is how politicians gain credibility within, for lack of a better word, the sort of expert foreign policy community and the Washington, D.C.-based foreign policy community, where you can rarely go wrong by sounding hawkish, by being in favor of U.S. global leadership and a rather forceful foreign policy. Even if that doesn't necessarily play particularly well in other parts of the country, it does play well in Washington. And what's important for a presidential candidate early on is to be sort of taken seriously, not suddenly be criticized by writers in the Washington Post and by columnists for magazines. And I think if you look at Hillary's foreign policy views over time, they've generally been rather conventional and very much in tune with what I would call the sort of Washington consensus on foreign policy. She has not staked out challenging, provocative, unusual leadership positions. And I think that's been sort of the secret to her political career ever since, again, she began running for office. As you say, the irony here is that that actually puts her at odds with the rather cautious and pragmatic foreign policy that Obama has tried to run and the rather cautious and pragmatic foreign policy that Bill Clinton ran when he was president.
So do you think that this is a tactic to sort of talk right and govern left. In other words, to placate your right flank. I mean, her embrace of Netanyahu at the time, where there was obviously some friction between the White House and Netanyahu, seems pretty much in that category.
Well, that I think is sort of classic American politics, right? That she is pandering to an influential interest group, a big source of campaign contributions, things like that. And, you know, Barack Obama did the same thing back in 2008, went to great lengths to try and make it clear that he was, you know, strongly pro-Israel and all of that. So that, I think, is not particularly surprising. We've even seen Rand Paul move in that direction as he's gotten more serious about his presidential ambitions. What I think she was trying to do is what almost every candidate has to do, which is, in a sense, product differentiation. She was trying to, in a delicate way, separate herself from Barack Obama's foreign policy. And when you think about it, given all the problems that are happening in the world today, whether it's the situation in Iraq or the situation in Syria or what's happening in Ukraine, there does seem to be a certain amount of disarray. And there's a natural tendency in the United States to sort of blame the U.S. president for all of these things. I think that's silly, but you can understand why Hillary, if she does have ambitions of getting in the White House, is not going to hug President Obama in any sort of serious, substantive way. She's going to try and say, well, you know, if I were president, if I were in charge, things would be better. No one is going to, I think, run without trying to distinguish themselves, at least partly, from the incumbent president.
Well, in terms of hugging Israel, which Hillary's done recently, I mean, there's an extraordinary story in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago of how the Israelis, through the Pentagon, through the civilian side of the Pentagon, managed to somehow get authorization to use pre-positioned American armaments, particularly ammunition, for their recent assault on Gaza, doing an end run around the White House itself. At the time when John Kerry, the Secretary of State, was trying to use some leverage against Netanyahu to come up with a peace deal, he was totally undercut by Israel's influence through AIPAC in Congress and in the Pentagon. I find that extraordinary. That's the article in the Wall Street Journal certainly made clear.
Yeah, well, and I think this is one of the reasons why American Middle East policy more broadly has never been as effective as we would like. I mean, Obama and Kerry, but also at various points the Bush administration, and certainly back in the 1990s, the Clinton administration, have all tried to push for a reasonable peace settlement, for a two-state solution, and for an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But for a variety of reasons, most of them having to do with American domestic politics and the power of AIPAC and other groups in the Israel lobby, they're never able to bring any American leverage to bear on both sides, to be able to push the Palestinians to make the adjustments they would need to make and to push Israel to make the concessions that Israel would need to make for there to be a lasting peace. We can only push on one side, and the other side, therefore, doesn't budge. And I think that's the main reason that 20-plus years of Middle East diplomacy have all failed, including Kerry's most recent attempt. And that leads to situations like repeated wars in Gaza and a declining American image in the region and a number of other problems as well. And until that changes, we're not going to see a more effective U.S. diplomacy there. Unfortunately, what Hillary is telling you in that interview when she talks about that particular problem is that if she's elected president, you shouldn't expect American policy to change very much. In the lines of the old movie, Americans should get used to disappointment on at least that particular front, whatever they might think about her qualifications as a candidate on other issues.
So, Stephen Walt, back to the president and the situation that he's in, given that he's had to go back to Washington away from his vacation to meet with his national security team. And presumably it's because there are two extremely volatile situations going on in the world, neither of which the U.S. is in total control of. Not that the U.S. is in control of what's happening in the world in the first place. I mean, you've got this volatile situation in Ukraine, which in many ways was made worse by Victoria Nuland and some of the neocons in the State Department who had worked with Hillary Clinton. But that aside, the other issue which we talked about is this idea that in recapturing the Mosul Dam, it's a very explosive situation. You could have a major catastrophe in a country, Iraq, that's had nothing but catastrophes since Bush and Cheney intervened there. In the category of the buck stops here, I guess we are in a situation now where if Obama can somehow make a deal with Putin, even though I think he despises him and the feeling's probably mutual, and if somehow they can, you know, neutralize ISIS without a massive catastrophe befalling Iraq yet again, he'll come out pretty well, won't he? And conversely, he's going to be hurt.
I think the two problems are not of equal magnitude. Solving the Ukraine problem, I think, is actually relatively simple, because what needs to happen is essentially a deal between the West and Russia that Ukraine will be independent and sovereign, but will be a neutral country, that we are not going to try to bring it into the EU quickly, and we're certainly not going to try to bring it into NATO. We would need to provide some guarantees to Russia that that project is done, it's finished, we're not going to try and pull Ukraine into the Western sphere of influence. And I think that deal is in everybody's best interest, including Russia's, and is a doable thing. He would get criticized if he did it, because there's been such a demonization of Russia, and all the blame has been put on them here in the United States. But I think from a purely diplomatic point of view, that's actually a relatively easy deal to cut. Situation in Iraq is, I think, much trickier. What the Obama administration will try to do is, first of all, work with the new Iraqi prime minister, whom they hope will adopt the policies that are designed to reconcile different groups within Iraq in ways that the previous prime minister, al-Maliki, did not. And then second, in very limited ways, try to limit the power of ISIS, at least contain it so that it doesn't continue to expand its control and expand its resource base. But I think Obama is very leery of using American ground forces to do that. I think that's not likely to happen. And there are going to be real limits to what the United States can accomplish through the use of air power, particularly if ISIS takes sort of rather straightforward and elementary countermeasures. So I think, in a sense, we may do a little bit here and there to try and limit ISIS's power, but ultimately we're going to hope that there is sufficient political reconciliation and reform in Baghdad that they, along with the Kurds and perhaps some other regional actors, will bear the principal burden of keeping ISIS from becoming more powerful.
And just to close, in terms of Ukraine, whoever ends up the victor, in quotes, in Ukraine, whether it's Russia or the US and the EU, the place is a basket case. So it will be a Pyrrhic victory.
Right. And we should not be thinking in terms of winning and losing here. We should be thinking in terms of situations that will or outcomes that will stabilize the situation and then allow the Ukrainians to begin to fix the things that are wrong inside their country. That's in our interest, that's in Russia's interest, and that's ultimately in the best interest of the people of Ukraine as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Walt.
Nice talking with you, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances and Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-authored with John Mearsheimer. His latest article at Foreign Policy is Double Dis.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died everywhere. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
I like to teach the crooks about a true democracy. Where working class kicks corporate ass from sea to shining sea. I'd like to give the coach the bird from my home.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Darrell West, who's a Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and the author of the forthcoming book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. He has an article in USA Today, Republican Big Bucks Backfire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Darrell. And the your article, I think, may be music to the ears of beleaguered Democrats who are always using the Koch brothers as sort of whipping boys. Not that perhaps they don't deserve it, but even Harry Reid has sort of made a career out of blaming the Koch brothers for everything. You're suggesting here that there may be, over time, a change where the heirs to some of these billionaires are likely to give their money to Democrats, the liberal children that will inherit the fortunes of these conservative plutocrats.
I mean, right now, conservatives applaud billionaires who are moving into the political arena because they see that more than two-thirds of them are on their side and are supporting conservative causes. But what they're ignoring is, you know, many of these billionaires are aging. They're in well into their 80s, and there have been several cases already of very conservative billionaires who have died, and their money has gone to much more liberal children. We saw the case of Harold Simmons, who was a Dallas billionaire who passed away in December. He was a guy who had told the Wall Street Journal about President Obama that Obama was the most dangerous American alive because he would eliminate free enterprise. But now that he is gone, his money has passed to his two daughters, Serena and Lisa. Both of them have a long history of supporting Democratic and progressive causes. They've contributed to Hillary Clinton. They've contributed to Barack Obama. So conservatives may rue the day that they welcomed all of this big money into politics if the money starts to go to more liberal children.
Well, already, though, there is a sort of canard, is there not, in the discourse, and I certainly get a lot of mail on this, that, you know, how can you complain about the Koch brothers when there's George Soros? But my understanding is that Soros is, he did, and I think a couple of cycles ago, gave a lot of money. Maybe it was 2004, I think. But he hasn't really given much money to the politics at all since then. So is there any, you know, and of course the hedge fund guy up in San Francisco, who formerly made a lot of money out of coal, is now become an environmentalist, and he got pretty much sort of discredited, or at least attempt was made to discredit him in a New York Times article. So do you think there is a parity at this point? I mean, why do people insist on arguing there is if there's not?
There is not parity in terms of big money going into politics because, for example, if you look at 2012 alone, the top 10 contributors to the super PACs, 80% of that money went in on the Republican side. In general, billionaires are more conservative in their political viewpoints. They favor small government. They're not big fans of regulation. They want low taxes. And so, you know, if we had a democracy where there were liberal billionaires and they were conservative billionaires and they basically canceled each other out, that would be fine, but that's not what we have.
And do you think that there's a whole bunch of ideas out there and constitutional amendments floating around and legislation and organizations talking about reversing Citizens United, but it looks like it'll be around for a while. Wouldn't you agree?
With the current Supreme Court that we have, there's likely to be more big money going into politics because this court does not see all the money going into politics as a big problem, and the rulings reflect that. And so I think what we need to focus on is just trying to improve the transparency in the system, that right now billionaires have combined electoral advocacy with issue advocacy and philanthropy that's pursuing partisan objectives. And they're doing a lot of this in secret. And that's the biggest complaint that I have about our current system, that essentially we have retreated to the pre-Watergate period of large money and great secrecy. And historically, that has been a very toxic combination for any kind of democratic political system.
And again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. He has an article in USA Today, Republican Big Bucks Backfire. So in terms of your forthcoming book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, is there, I mean, to my mind, it's pretty straightforward that, you know, you have billionaires in social democratic countries like Germany and Sweden, and yet the people in those countries get 6 weeks vacation for comprehensive single-payer health care, pregnancy leave, child care, all kinds of government services in exchange for paying their taxes. We get very little in terms of government services back for our taxes, and more the wealthiest pay less and less taxes, leaving a disproportionate burden on the middle class and on working Americans. So why have we, I mean, isn't it a zero-sum situation that basically the reason that the rich have gotten richer in this country and the poor have gotten poorer is because of our tax system? I mean, it seems logical to me.
The tax system certainly is a big contributor to the growing income concentration that we see. The tax rates are very favorable to people who have money. I mean, for example, if you look at the Koch brothers, they have $100 billion in assets between the two of them. Their money is likely appreciating at a minimum of 5 to 10% a year, which means they are making $5 to $10 billion each year just out of appreciation. So, for example, this year when they're spending, you know, over $100 million trying to influence those 5 or 6 Senate races, that expenditure isn't even denting their net worth. They can fund that out of capital appreciation and still have a lot left over.
So I know it's become an issue, and one of the more stark statistics I've heard is that the lower 40% of all American families, their wealth is equivalent to one family in the United States, the heirs to the Walmart fortune. And I know in your article you mentioned that some of the younger Waltons, including the grandson, are now giving money to Democrats and to Hillary and to Obama. But that in itself is pretty extraordinary. Is there any explanation for why the American people don't see the basic unfairness of that situation?
Well, some Americans do see that kind of unfairness. And when you look at the historical patterns on income concentration, you know, we had this period in the 1920s when the top 1% made 21% of the income. But then that dropped down to 9% in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. So we started to have more equity in the process at that point. But now the 1% are back to making 20% of the income. So we've essentially reverted to the patterns that we saw in the 1920s. But we now are combining that very high income concentration with Supreme Court rulings that essentially have taken all of the restrictions, even in terms of disclosing expenditures, off of rich people. We have a news media that nationally is very weak, and so it's hard for them to exercise their role in terms of accountability. And you have a number of billionaires who are buying media outlets. So we've had a situation arise here where you have a combination of a lot of wealth, a weak countervailing institutions, and basically rich people buying a news outlet. So that can be a very bad combination for a democracy.
But I thought in many ways that the surreptitious taping of Mitt Romney's talk to a bunch of wealthy donors revealed a fairly pervasive mindset, at least amongst the wealthy, and to some extent it's reflected in the Republican Party. And that is this idea that 47% of the people in the United States are basically freeloaders, and that there is this division between makers and takers. And it does seem that a lot of working and middle-class Americans have bought into this idea that there are a bunch of sort of freeloaders who are basically, the government is there for freeloaders as opposed to be a social democracy, as I mentioned before, where other governments around the world have raised the standard of living of their people through social democracy and fair taxation where everybody benefits. But here it seems, and right next door you have examples in Canada, but here it seems to be, and I don't know whether that's because of the Rupert Murdochs of this world, but why is it that the rich are not so much vilified as the poor are vilified?
I mean, you're right that Romney's speech really did provide a good perspective on how a number of these people think, that they do think that many Americans are on the take. They're just, being supported by government programs, and they're not out doing anything and creating products. The problem from the standpoint of public opinion is a lot of Americans still hope to become rich, and so therefore they support policies that end up benefiting the rich, even though the reality is that, maybe in an earlier time period, if you worked hard, had good ideas, you could grow up to become rich. Today, it's harder and harder just because many of the things that advance social and economic opportunity have grown much weaker. Our education system is weaker. Students graduate with a lot of debt. And so it's just harder for that pro-opportunity argument to be true in fact.
So will this, do you think, get beyond political spin and counterspin and become a moral issue? Because the great changes that took place in the United States over the decades and even centuries, I guess, going back to slavery, came as moral movements, whether it was the end of slavery or the civil rights movement, et cetera. This is a very religious country, and I find it extraordinary that it isn't a religious issue. But then on the other hand, you've got these televangelists on the political right who in many ways are just a front for right-wing politics, and they preach the gospel of prosperity. God wants you to be a winner, not a whiner.
I mean, certainly the gospel of prosperity would be great if there actually were opportunities for the average person. I mean, I know when I was growing up in the 1970s, it was possible to go to public schools, get a good education, and make something of yourself. I think today it's a lot harder to do that. Our education system isn't as strong as it used to be. You have tax policies that deliver many benefits to the wealthy. And so people have to wake up that there's a real problem here, and that it's a problem not just in terms of the economy, but in terms of our political system, because people are using their economic power to gain political power.
So I guess we've run out of time. I'm sorry, because I'm very interested in the conversation. I'm particularly interested in your book. So can we have another conversation when the book comes out?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Darrell West.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who's a vice president for governance studies at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. He has an article in USA Today, Republican Big Bucks Backfire. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Love.